Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, tonight we're going to take you on some mysteries, ancient mysteries, with a very special guest, Maurice Cotterell, as we go live to Ireland, where he is. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. In 1989, engineer and scientist Maurice Cotterell find a way of calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals in the sun. In using this knowledge, he was able to break the codes of the sun-worshipping civilizations of the world, first the Mayas of Mexico and then those in Egypt, and then in South America, the ancient Chinese and now European Celts. Their secret knowledge of the super science of the sun and the higher order of spirituality enabled him to locate the Holy Grail, the subject of his next book, due out in Easter. We'll chat just a little bit with Maurice about that. Tonight, he talks about all of the sun-worshipping civilizations and how and why they left behind their knowledge and their treasures, why they encoded it, and how and why they all used the same methods of encoding, despite thousands of years elapsing between their civilizations. How'd they do that? The remarkable ancient stories explain why we live, why we die, what God is, what the soul is, what is hell, what is heaven, how reincarnation works, and how to get there, and how to survive in this life. Back, Maurice Cotterell. Maurice, how are you? It's been a long time.
George. How are you?
Good to talk with you. You know, when I was first starting Coast to Coast, way back, you were one of my first guests, and I'll never forget the mosaics that you sent me, and I looked at them and played with them and turned them around for hours, and it is amazing how the ancients worked on codes and things like that. It's simply amazing, and how you were able to decipher it was equally amazing. Really was. Nice job.
Thank you, George.
Maurice, your work into the ancient civilizations goes, as I was saying, way back. What was it that either got you interested in it or somehow steered you in that direction?
Well, it goes back a long time, George, to when I was a boy. I used to keep pigeons at the age of 8 years old when I lived in Manchester in England. And I was fascinated how the pigeon found its way home after you released it some miles away from where it was actually born. And I noticed that the pigeon would circle once or twice in the sky and then zigzag across the horizon back to the place where it was born. I thought, well, it must be using some sort of sensing of the Earth's magnetic field, or perhaps the angles of the sun, or something to get itself back home. And it was a question that perplexed me for many years. And then, a few years later, I went to college as a radio officer to join the Merchant Marine, the Merchant Navy, and I traveled the world many times. And one day I was on board a ship in the wheelhouse in storm, and I was watching the compass, the gyro compass, go backwards and forwards every time the ship was knocked off course. And I looked at the course plotter, which plots the course the ship is taking across the ocean, and it was zigzagging. What was happening was, as a wave came in from one side of the ship, it pushed the ship off course. The gyro compass would sense the magnetic deviation, send the rudder in the opposite direction to send the ship back on its course again. Excuse me.
You're okay there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine, George. Thanks.
Okay.
And it occurred to me that the pigeon must have been doing the same sort of sensing of the magnetic field to come out and follow the same course as the course plotter on board ship. So I became very interested in how a biological creature like a pigeon could sense magnetic energy and navigate in such a sophisticated way. And then whilst I was on board ship, I noticed behavioral changes in the people around me. For example, when the ship was going from north to south, people were very calm. But when the ship started going from east to west, they got very agitated.
Interesting.
And they started to fall out with each other. So I became interested in jet lag, interested in how magnetic fields could affect the brain and so on. And then as on my first trip, I went to China around the Cape of Good Hope, around South Africa. And it was very difficult to communicate with the UK at that time because we were going through a period of intense solar magnetic activity, which disrupted the upper atmosphere and prevented the radio signals getting through to the UK. So I became very interested in sunspots, which is an 11.5-year cycle, solar cycle, which we've known for years, since the ancient Chinese.
That's right.
And as it happens, we were sailing to China, and when I got there, I started to talk to Chinese people, to monks, to I visited the temples and so on, and I became interested in Chinese astrology, which had a 12-year cycle. And I began to consider whether or not all of these variables might be connected, whether or not the sun could be causing personality traits to be developed in human beings, and so on. And I spent the good next 20 years after that trying to find out how astrology worked, if it did indeed work, using a scientific rationale, and how the sun's radiation affects living organisms on the Earth. And it was in about 1985 that I come up with a theory to accommodate astrological personality determination, how the sun could possibly affect people's character in a scientific way. And it was when I started to really investigate how the sun's magnetic fields interact with themselves and how they interact with the Earth that the picture began to become very much clearer. And once I started to get into that, I put together a model which explained that the sun spins on its axis. It's a very sort of complex relationship where the north pole and the south pole of the sun spin much more slowly than its equator. It's like a ball of sticky gas, a plasma.
Right.
And as it spins, the two magnetic fields interfere with each other. And what that means is we get different combinations of particles coming off the sun. Every single month, every 30 days, we get a different bunch of particles coming off. And we actually discovered these in 1962. Mariner 2 spacecraft detected the sectored structure of the solar wind. And what that means is it detected negative particles coming off the sun and positive particles. And the negative particles are quite straightforward electrons, which are in the atom. The positive particles were the hydrogen nucleus. As the atoms smashed together in the sun, then particles are released. Then I realized that all of these discoveries were happening simultaneously in America, all around the world. People were discovering different things, but nobody put the complete picture together, it seems, at least until I came along. In the Reagan administration, Dr. Ross Adie, the White House chief medical advisor, discovered in 1989, for example, that modulating magnetic fields were affecting the brains of pigeons and excuse me, hamsters and creatures like that. And what he found was that it was affecting the biorhythms of the animal and the manufacture of melatonin, the timing hormone.
Is that because we're so electrical, all of us, that if you throw something off, if you throw a magnetic reversal at us, if there's an electromagnetic change, that it just really plays havoc with us?
It does. It has two effects. One, it determines our personality before we're born, and then after that, it regulates our behavior once we're alive for the 70 years that we're here, if you like. And the way I figured out it was all working was as the sun showers particles towards the Earth, the particles get trapped in the Van Allen belts. The magnetic field of the Earth changes, it modulates, and that magnetic field affects the amount of the chemical intensity, if you like, of the DNA in the cells. It makes them very chemically reactive. The cells become very chemically reactive, the DNA. And the DNA sections are spliced into different order. They're reordered because they behave like scissors. The chemically reactive DNA sequences behave like scissors and start chopping up the DNA and rearranging it. So what this means is, every month we have a different type of radiation, and that causes different genetic mutations in early impregnated ovum in the womb. So as the cells are dividing, the DNA is chopped around and changed, and that leads to a different personality. Because we've known for years, or many believe, that personality is genetically related.
That's fascinating.
If you change the genes, we change the personality.
We are going through a magnetic reversal now, and I truly believe it could be a total flip. I want to talk with you a little bit about that before we get into some of these ancient civilizations. But are you, Maurice, are you seeing signs of this flip already?
I have to be honest, I can't see signs of a flip, but then again, I'm biased because of my own calculations. It would appear from the ancient records, from all of these ancient civilizations, that there was a neutral sheet shift on the sun. Now, let me just explain what that is, because several people don't really understand what we talk about when we're talking about magnetic reversals. Now, the sun has a north pole and a south pole, and this magnetic, the north pole and the south pole magnetic fields reverse. We know this every 22 years, and that doesn't seem to have any effect on Earth. We're talking about a different type of magnetic reversal on the sun, which happens over thousands of years. And it's what we would expect the sun to have is a north pole and a south pole, just like the Earth, a magnetic north and a magnetic south.
All right.
Now, we would expect the area around the sun's equator, therefore, to be neutral. It's neither north, it's neither south. But in fact, the sun's equatorial region is not like that. It's actually warped. If you can imagine a CD, which is warped, it's been near a fire, and it's actually got a warp in it, it's like that. And also the sun spins on its axis. So you've got this wobbling disk going through space, if you like, and that affects the radiation coming out of the sun. And what we know is that there's a 3,740-year magnetic cycle on the sun, which the ancient civilizations were aware of. And they knew this because the Mayan calendar, for example, begins in the year 3,113 B.C.
Well, how did they know that? I want you to explain what this is, but how did they know this? They didn't have scientific equipment, did they?
They were far more advanced than we are, far more advanced. And we're only coming to terms with this as we... The computer's been very, very helpful to us. The computer, in my view, has been one of the major discoveries of mankind.
I agree,
And it's not just because of what the computer can do for us. It's because of how the computer works. You know, if you go back to, I think it was 1895 in England, we were going through the Industrial Revolution, but nobody wanted to invest in companies because they could lose their shirt if the company went bust.
Mm-hmm.
So they introduced legislation called the Companies Act, which allowed shareholders to limit their liability to the amount of shares they owned in the company. So if the company went bust, instead of losing your house and your car and the shirt on your back, all you would lose is the shares that you owned.
And how much and whatever you invested in them, I guess,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
And so we introduced the notion of a limited liability, and that really provided a tremendous impetus to the Industrial Revolution. Everybody started to invest in companies. Commerce took off, and as you know, the UK went through an Industrial Revolution that swept the world.
Sure.
Now, a similar thing has happened in regard to encoding of information by ancient civilizations. Now, when we go back to the computer, there was a tremendous break in thinking when the computer arrived. Instead of having a different instrument or a different machine to do a different job, we had the same machine with different software, with different instructions. And that was a complete change in human thinking. And what that has enabled me to do is look at human beings in the same way as a computer. The brain is the central processing unit.
Yeah.
We've got input devices like the eyes, the ears, the touch, the senses, and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. Now, once we get down to the software, you begin to understand that if you want people to behave differently, for example, if you want women to behave differently to men, you just change the software, the instructions. You change the hormones. So you can change men's behavior by changing the amount of testosterone. You can change the behavior of women by changing their chemical software, the estrogen and progesterone. And this is exactly what happens with the sun now. Now we can go back to the sun and see how the analogy works.
Okay, good.
The sun's radiation sends off particles. The particles interfere with the Earth's magnetic belts. The magnetic field wobbles around the Earth. That affects the behavior of the brain. The brain produces different amounts of hormones, and the hormones affect behavior. And because the radiation is a dynamic process, it's changing all the time as the sun's spinning, our behavior is changing cyclically over days, weeks, months, years, thousands of years. And there are longer-term effects, and one of the effects on the sun, as well as affecting the human brain and the biology, the sun spins If you're on the Earth and you look at the sun, it spins once every 28 days. This is why females menstruate once every 28 days. It's quite straightforward. Now, of course, there are exceptions. And there are exceptions because when the polar field interferes with the equatorial field, every fourth month you'll get a variation in the duration of the cosmic cycle, the magnetic cycle, such that it's plus or minus 4 days. So a normal menstruation period would be expected to be 28 days, 28 days, 28 days, 32 days, 28, 28, 28, 24, 28, 28, and so on, as the polar cap interferes with the cyclicity of the radiation coming off the sun.
There were not a lot of people aware of this at all.
No. But the ancients were, and this is why they worshipped the sun as the god of fertility and the god of astrology. And they realized that when the neutral sheet, this equatorial warped disk around the sun center, it wobbles backwards and forwards over thousands of years, that when it flips from the northwest to southwest direction, then the magnetic, it's not the polar magnetic field, it's the entire magnetic field of the sun changes its vibration. And that flips the Earth off its axis. Or it can do, not every time. Now, if we look at the ancient inscriptions from all of the civilizations, we learn that the planet Venus was flipped off its axis in 3113 BC, which is about 5,000 years ago. Now, what happened at that time was the sun's magnetic field flipped. Venus, the closest planet, apart from Mercury, of course, and we don't know if Mercury flipped or not.
Right. Venus took a big hit, right?
Venus took a big hit. The Earth was further away, so we escaped a pole tilt. That's what we call them on that occasion.
Is this done, like, automatically or, I mean, quickly?
It seems that it has to happen very, very quickly, instantaneously. It builds up over 187 years until it reaches a critical level, and then it flips instantly. And this is why Venus spins backwards. It's the only planet which goes in the opposite direction to all of the others, because it was turned upside down.
That's true.
And it's also got a very, very slow rotation. It takes, you know, 200 days to spin once on its axis. So it's a very long day, if you like.
You mean the planet was physically turned upside down?
Yes, no question about it.
Now, what if that were to happen to us today, and the Earth was completely turned around, what would happen to us?
Well, Velikovsky, the 1950s scientist, wrote a considerable amount on catastrophes that have frequented the Earth. And he questioned why we have thousands and thousands of mammoths in Siberia, all piled on top of each other. Why we have these great geological evidence of geological upheavals and volcanic activities and so on. And Velikovsky almost had it right. He figured out most of the mechanism, but he didn't have the scientific input at that time in the 1950s to get a complete picture. And because of that, he was ridiculed, sadly. But he did his best he could at the time. For example, he said, how could the Earth tilt on its axis? And he said, well, maybe, let's say a chunk of Jupiter flew across the solar system and it made the Earth topple on its axis. Well, of course, everybody laughed at him. He was doing his best to explain why the Earth tilted, and he went a bridge too far. Now, he didn't realize that the sun's magnetic field flips, and therefore the Earth can flip on its axis. And one of Velikovsky's observations was fantastically intelligent, because he pointed out that nobody understands what causes ice ages on the Earth. And if we look at how ice ages are defined, that's with the size of the polar caps. If they're large polar caps that cover a large landmass, then we say we're in a period of ice age.
Yeah.
If they shrink, then we go back to a warmer period, an interglacial period.
Which I think we're in now, but some people say maybe not.
So absolutely. And just going back to Velikovsky, what he said was, look, I don't understand how these work, because if the planet gets colder, there's less water to evaporate water from the oceans. Therefore, you're going to get less rain. And if you get less rain, the ice caps can't grow, because you've got less water, less snow. So
that's
impossible.
Right.
Now, if the Earth gets warmer, then the ice caps must melt, even though you get more evaporation of water. So it's impossible to have ice ages. So it was a paradox, and he scratched his head and said, well, we know we get ice ages because we have the evidence all around us. So he sat down and tried to figure out how they could be happening. And he said, look, the only way these can be happening is to heat the Earth up from the inside out. That would cause the oceans to boil, more precipitation, more rainfall, colder temperatures, ice caps would grow. So he said, what could possibly cause the Earth to heat up from the inside? And he didn't know. But now we do know, because if the sun's magnetic field twists and the Earth does not twist off its axis, then the magma inside the Earth starts to pass eddy currents and the Earth starts to heat up from the inside.
Hold that thought, Maurice. We'll be back. Fascinating.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Getting lonely, getting old, can you feel me? Hey you, standing in the aisles with itchy feet and fainting smiles, can you feel me? Hey you, don't help them to bury the
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, the June issue of the After Dark newsletter will be a special UFO edition, guest edited by our very own webmaster Lex Lonehood. Take advantage of it. Get 14 issues for the price of 12 and the collector's item UFO edition of the After Dark newsletter. Couple ways to order. Of course, you can go to the coasttocoastam.com website. Click the orange type to that very secure server or call this toll-free number. It's your choice. 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505 or go online. Coast2TO, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Maurice Cotterill. Maurice, we were talking about the Earth, how it heats up from within. Let's go back to that.
Thank you, George, yes. one of the objections to pole tilting is that the Earth could not have tilted on its poles because the polar caps, the ice caps on Earth, are millions of years old. And we know this from ice cores. So people say, well, look, if the Earth tilted up its axis, the poles would have finished up at the equator and would have melted, and new polar caps would have formed. Therefore, the Earth has never tilted on its axis. But of course, once we understand this heating up from within process, then what's happening is, as the Earth heats up from within, and as the magma becomes hotter and the pressure starts to increase, there is a propensity for more volcanic activity. Another effect is that the ice at the interface between the planet and the cap itself, where it touches the Earth, becomes slushy because the Earth is getting hotter underneath it. So it starts to slide on a cushion of slush. So when the magnetic reversal actually arrives, the Earth flips on its axis, but it leaves the polar caps behind relative to space. So the polar caps don't melt, and the polar caps still go back millions of years. It's just that they refix themselves back to the poles as the Earth cools down again, as the cycle ends, or the next ice age begins, and so on. So we can understand how all of these things can react. Now, some other observers have said, well, cosmic dust causes ice ages, because if you look at the ice cause this cosmic dust every time we have an ice age. Therefore, we must be getting clouds of cosmic dust covering the Earth. The Earth sunlight gets blocked out, the Earth gets colder, and we get the ice age. But as we've seen, you don't get an ice age because it gets colder, so something else must be going on. And what happens is, as the sun's magnetic field changes polarity, it's like the sun is breathing. For 3,000 years, it breathes out, then it breathes in, then it breathes out, then it breathes in. As it breathes in, it pulls cosmic dust into the solar system. And the evidence of that is in the ice cores. So the cosmic dust is not the cause of ice ages. It's a result of the sun's reversing magnetic field. It's a total irrelevance. So now we can understand why and how the sun tilts on its axis as we get one of these neutral sheet reversals. Now, the sun also, as we've discussed, affects fertility on Earth, because we know when we get a period of high sunspot activity, we get fewer babies born, and when we get lower sunspot activity, we get when we get higher sunspot activity, we get more particles coming off the sun, and we get more magnetic modulations on the around the Earth, and we get more fertility on Earth. When we get less sunspots, we get less fertility on Earth. And the Mayas calculated that there would be less fertility in the year 627 AD. Now, their calendar began in 3113 BC, and they calculated that 1,366,040 days later, the sun's magnetic field would shift from a northeasterly to a southeasterly direction, and that would have several effects. One, there'd be less fertility on Earth, because a neutral sheet shift and sunspot cycle prevalence both affect the amount of fertility on Earth. They knew that when the neutral sheet shifts, more X-rays bombard the Earth, so you'd get more infant mortality. More babies would be lost through miscarriage. We know that mini ice ages occur when we get a sunspot maximum. What that meant was, for the Maya, is that an ice age occurred simultaneously in 627 AD, which gave them drought, less crops, and so they died from starvation, more so than their neighbors in the north and to the south. The third effect of solar reversals, clearly, is the pole tilt. If the pole tilts in its axis, we're all destroyed anyway, as we get volcanic eruptions, landslides, and all the tectonic plates start to move around. Now, clearly, that did not happen in 627 AD. The Earth didn't tilt, but the Maya died out. There was less fertility-inspiring solar radiation. There were more X-rays. There was a drought globally, but it affected the equatorial regions more severely. And this is why the Maya died out in the year 627 AD, plus or minus 187 years, because that's how long it takes to come in and how long it takes to go out again.
So let's talk a little bit then about that favorite year of mine, 2012, with the Mayans knowing something. Some people think it's a moment of enlightenment. That's what I say, Maurice. Some people think it's end times. What do you think?
Well, it's something I studied in some depth in the Mayan prophecies. In 1989, I actually went down to Palenque in Mexico because it began to become clear that the Mayas understood the solar cycles. For example, I had calculated on a computer that the sunspot cycle would be 1,366,040 days long. And the Maya worshipped that number. They encoded it in one of their treasures, the Sun Shield of Monte Alban. And they also worshipped a number very close to that, very, very close. Instead of 1,366, 040, they worshipped a date 520 days longer, 1,366,560 days, and they call that the birth of Venus. And clearly at first I began to consider that clearly their calendar must have begun in 3113, and they expected the sun's magnetic field to twist in 627 AD, and that would cause Venus to topple on its axis, and we'd have the rebirth of Venus in 627 AD. Now, the actual toppling didn't occur. The Maya died out as predicted. The mini ice age happened as predicted. The drought happened as predicted. But the magnetic twist was not clearly strong enough to tilt either Venus or the Earth off its axis in 627 AD. But I started to look at this birth of Venus and the rebirth of Venus number, and I started to think these guys obviously understood the sun cycles better than we did. So I went down to Palenque in Mexico, and I went to the Temple of Inscriptions. I got all the information I could. I brought it back to the UK. I started to analyze it all, and I broke the code of the Maya carving. I broke the code of Lord Peikal's sarcophagus lid, the five-ton lid that covers his coffin in the pyramid at Palenque. And this revealed lots and lots of pictures, moving pictures, some of them, like videos. I know it sounds bizarre, but if you check into the website, www.morriscottrell.com, you'll see some of these videos in action, the actual animations that come out of this decoding. Now, one of the decoded pictures, after about 11 months' work on the lid, I came out with an incredible picture of Lord Peikal's head and face.
I think you provided that to us with a link right up on the website right now.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I noticed something quite extraordinary. On his head, and we're going back now, don't forget, 1,250 years, on his head he had Arabic numerals, the type of numbers we use today, 144000, 144,000. And I thought, well, that's weird. I mean, it can't have that on his forehead. A, they didn't use numbers like that in those days, and the Maya certainly didn't use Arabic numerals like that. And it must be my imagination.
Wasn't that the number in the Bible?
It's the number in the Bible.
People were going to be taken. Yeah.
It says that those with 144,000 on their foreheads will go to heaven. Now, when I had this picture, I completely freaked out just with the picture. I was just overwhelmed with emotion. I'd never seen anything like it in my whole life. It was a living miracle as far as I was concerned. And a friend of mine came round to the house, and I showed him the picture, and he freaked out. And I said, but look, what do you make of this? 144,000 on his forehead. He said, well, that's amazing. He said, that's in the Bible. I said, I know, but it can't be. He said, oh, I'd put that in the book if I were you. I was writing the Mayan prophecy at the time. I said, I can't put this in the book. They'd think I've gone off my trolley. They'd think I was completely mad. So I didn't even mention it in the Mayan prophecies because I thought, well, there's no point. But from that moment on, in 1992, 93, I started to look at all this in a different way, and I got the Bible out. I looked at the book of Revelation where it talks of the 144,000. And on the last page of the book of Revelation, the last page in the Bible, the second to the last paragraph, Jesus says, I am the bright and morning star. Jesus says, I am Venus. Now I thought, that's extraordinary. Why would Jesus, in the Bible, tell us he was Venus? And then, if you read on another paragraph, it says, never change a word in the book of Revelation. Not one word, not one sentence, not one comma, not one full stop. You must never do that. So I went back to the expression again. I, Jesus, am the bright and morning star. The bright star is Venus in the morning. So the bright star is Venus in the dark evening sky. And the morning star is clearly when Venus is on the opposite side of the sun, and it appears as a morning star. As I started to decode more and more Mayan artifacts, the stories became more and more bizarre and interesting and fascinating. Once I'd broken the code of the amazing lid of Palenque, I used the same techniques on Maya paintings, Maya jewelry, and Maya architecture, and each time I could access information which had never been accessed before. And, for example, one of the Mayan paintings from a temple in the jungle at Bonampak, which is about 150 miles southwest of Palenque, it says that Lord Peikal was known as Venus. He was born amongst animals with horns, that he grew up, and he died on a cross made of two pieces of wood.
How strange.
Now, I thought, this is quite extraordinary, because it says when Lord Peikal died, he became Venus, which is like Jesus. Jesus was born in a stable surrounded by cattle with horns.
That's right.
And the picture started to fill out and become clearer and clearer. But I thought, well, I just don't understand it. I couldn't make the connection. My intellectual processing wouldn't allow the connection, because after all, the Maya existed in 750 AD and Jesus existed 750 years earlier. I then started to decode the mosaic mask, which was a mask across Lord Peikal's face, and I found more pictures. It said he came to the throne at the age of 9. It showed him wearing a feathered hat, like Tutankhamun in Egypt. And it showed him as a feathered snake. His people regarded Lord Paykel as the eagle in the sky and the snake on the ground. Now, at first, quite innocently, I thought, well, I guess the eagle represents the spirit soaring in the sky, and the snake must represent the body which reincarnates on earth or sheds its skin. But there was much more to it, and I was missing the point. Then I thought, hang on a minute, Tutankhamun was known to his people as the feathered snake. He carried the vulture and the snake on his forehead. And then I started to get more and more information, so I went down to the Valley of the Kings in Egypt, and I went to Tutankhamun's tomb. And on the wall, there's a painting of Tutankhamun shaking hands with Nut, goddess of the night sky. And then, in an animated picture next to him, as though it's in the next frame, the next time frame, we see Tutankhamun as twins, two people, shaking hands with Osiris. He's the god of resurrection that lives in the constellation of Orion in the sky. So what this tells us was that when Tutankhamun died, he became the twins, the twin planet Venus, the morning star and the evening star.
And are we talking about the same thing, that Tutankhamun also might have been Lord Paykel?
There's no question about it. Once I started decoding the treasures of Tutankhamun, Tutankhamun means the son of God. And look at Lord Paykel. Pascal means Easter.
Yeah, but all these civilizations, Bruce, were at different time periods, weren't they?
Of course they were. Thousands of years between them.
So here's a question then. Were we talking about one event, the event that we know about, and that all these other civilizations somehow heard about it and encoded it, or did this event occur for each civilization with the same person?
I put the evidence together. I put it all over my house on the floor because there was so much of it. There was just so many pages of it printed out from the computer. And I scratched my head month after month. And it was all the same information from the Egyptians, from the Mayas, from the Peruvians, from the Chinese. The same story in the same detail. There was no stone unturned. And I thought, it can't be. It can't be the same guy. If you go to the Valley of the Kings, the bones of Tut are in the tomb. If you go to Lord Paykel's tomb, his bones are in the tomb. If you go to Peru, the Viracochas, the guys who produced miracles in Peru in ancient times, the bones are in the tomb. So these were different living beings. So if they were different living beings, the only explanation, therefore, must be, given the detail of the information, which was so prevalent and common to each civilization, is that it had to be the reincarnation of the spiritual energy of the same guy in a different body at different moments in the history of the planet. And once I got that round my head, I then began to think, well, okay, this guy is telling us he keeps coming back. Perhaps we can keep coming back. Is that why they kept encoding this information into their artifacts? And then the more I learned about the Egyptians, for example, how they preserved their internal organs in canopic jars, but they didn't preserve the heart and the brain, I started to look at these exceptions to this reincarnation rule. In the simple sense, it would appear that you mummified a body so that if you came back, you could reuse it. But it didn't make sense. How could you reuse a body with no heart and no brain? So I thought, this is telling us something. What are they trying to communicate? They're trying to communicate in a way which transcends time barriers. They're trying to communicate. I already knew that they communicated with pictures and numbers, not language. You don't use language to set down information. Because, for example, if you're reincarnated in a different country and you spoke a different language, you would never be able to understand the information you left behind the first time you were here. So you've got to use a mechanism of encoding information which will carry over globally. And so what they did was they knew a picture would be worth 1,000 words, and the picture is seen by everybody in the same way. So Jesus taught in parables so that disbelievers would not see the hidden picture. Lord Paykel taught in pictures with his hidden Maya transformers, these pictures that transform into hundreds of pictures once you break the code. Tutankhamun spoke in pictures. But going back to the heart, I thought, well, okay, what's clear is that when we're born, like a computer again, we have a memory. We have ROM, random access memory, read-only memory, ROM and RAM. And when we have a new computer, for example, the memory is empty. And without wishing to deviate too much, there was a quiz program recently on the UK television where two universities on television sit down and answer questions in a quiz master.
And they're battling against each other.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the compere of the show decided it would be a good idea to have all the old students back from 30 years ago. And so we had two teams of old men, if you like, 55, 60 years old.
Hey, be careful, not that old.
And he was fascinated to compare how the old people were so much slower at pressing the buzzer and answering the question. And he dismissed it as a quirk of getting old. But to me, I find that fascinating as an indicator of how the brain actually works. Now, if you have a new computer and you run scan disk to find out if there are any corruption on the disks, it takes about 10 seconds
because there's
nothing on the
disk. There's nothing there, right.
But if you have a computer full of information and you run scan disk, it can take half an hour.
That's true.
Because every single bit of information has to be checked for correctness. Now, when we're young and we're asked a question, because we're young and stupid and we have no wisdom, we give the answer we believe must be correct. For example, who won the Second World War? Answer, America and its allies, including Britain. If you're 55 years old and somebody asks you who won the Second World War, you do a scan disk in your head. You check every memory bank, and the answer is nobody won the Second World War. Nobody wins a war because you have wisdom. And this is the difference. What was thrown away as an inconsequential quirk of behavior in old men, to me, was a key to understanding how the brain works, how the mind works, how the heart works, and so on. And this is why, as I said earlier, the advent of computers has helped so much in our understanding of how the mind, the body, and the heart work.
When we come back, Maurice, we'll talk a little bit more about these mysteries of ancient civilizations. Talk very briefly. I know you really can't dive into it about the Holy Grail, but we'll just get some highlights from you on that as well.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now.